welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. George, how's it going?
Hi, really good, thank you.
Excellent. A little bit of background about George. So George is a Sunday Times best-selling author, comic writer and editor. He's currently writing a series of Doctor Who and Warhammer 40,000 comics with Titan Comics. His most recent novel, Witchwood, is a paranormal police procedural and it's out now. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Great. Okay, so what I like to do to start off with is a few warm-up questions. So think of it as being some, you know, calisthenics, you know, some stretches, a few scales maybe. So you write a lot of different things. What is your favourite writing medium?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I think it probably is long-form prose, really, writing novels. It's really difficult because in the last few years, you mentioned earlier, I started writing comics as well, and I really, really enjoy writing comic scripts. They're so quick and punchy, and they really kind of make you focus because you've only got 22 pages to tell a story, so you've really got to kind of focus on and boil down the story to its key component parts, and I think that's really helped me as a storyteller overall. But I still think I get the most satisfaction from writing a novel, the achievement of kind of climbing that mountain and telling a big, long story like that. That's probably, I'd say, long-form prose novels.
So I imagine that's taught you to be a plotter. Were you a plotter or a pantser before that?
I tried being a pantser when I first started. And I used to inevitably get to chapter 7. I don't know why it was always chapter 7. I'd get to chapter 7 and the whole thing would collapse. So I learned very quickly that I had to plot, and that's how I work. And so, yes, I do a plot in quite detail, really. But I've started just in the last few years to relax a little bit, to trust myself a little bit more. And also I'll put a scaffold up. But I'll allow myself to go, you know, off that a little bit, as long as I know that where I have to come back to, if you see what I mean. So I go and explore and kind of meander a little bit and let the characters tell their story as well. But I always know where they have to get to keep the main plot going as well. So I don't go off the beaten track for too long.
Sounds like an ominous name, like the dreaded Chapter 7 or something.
I know. Yeah, I should put that in a book at some point. I'm always happy when I get past chapter 7 now.
Woohoo, past chapter 7. Okay, so when you're writing, what is your writing fuel of choice?
Generally coffee, sometimes biscuits. But yeah, definitely coffee. I can't live without the stuff, to be honest. If I don't have a cup of coffee in the morning, I start getting a headache, which I know is a bad sign. But I'll generally have a coffee with my breakfast and then another one mid-morning, and then I tend to stop and switch to Earl Grey tea for the rest of the day. Otherwise, it keeps me awake at night. But when I'm deep in a book and working furiously, and you know, I'll be drinking coffee constantly, basically. I tend to have a very intense period on every book, about 2 weeks, right in the middle of the book, where I'm basically living and breathing the book and surviving on coffee and biscuits. So yes, that's definitely my fuel. I do listen to a lot of music as well, actually. That feeds me and my writing. So not while I'm writing. I don't like music when I'm writing, but I take a lot of inspiration from songs. I often find there's a song or a sequence of songs or an artist that I come to associate with every book and it becomes a thing that I go back to help me capture the tone. So if I've been away from my computer and I come back to the computer, I'll play that song or that artist, and that'll get me back into the right frame of mind for writing the book. So it's a useful tool. So that's fuel of a different sort, I suppose.
So that's like a kind of, not quite a soundtrack, but yeah, an inspiration. So have you got an example?
So there's an artist called Lila Foy, who's a kind of a female singer-songwriter, quite relaxed, quite poetic songs. And she released an EP a couple of years ago, and those kind of four songs really, while I was writing the book Ghost of Karnak, they became the soundtrack of that book, really. And to the extent that I dedicated the book to her, actually, on that occasion. But that's true of every project, really, not just book. It's true of short stories. It doesn't really apply as much to comics, but for prose, there's usually some music. So I'm listening to Gabriel Aplin at the moment a lot while I'm working on the new book as well.
Wow, great. That must have been pretty exciting. Does she know, does Lila Foy know that you dedicated the book to her?
Yes, Lila does. Yeah, I unfortunately never met Lila, but we've talked a bit on Twitter and online, and she sent me some records and I sent her some books, and we've had a cultural exchange.
Oh, cool.
which is very nice.
Okay, so we've got to know you a little bit more about that part of your writing. So let's get a bit more in depth. So how do you describe your writing, and are there themes that you explore?
I guess for any writer, you're not necessarily always aware of what your themes are. I think other people tend to pick up things in your writing. But one thing that I do know that I very consciously tend to explore, and it's quite a wide theme that I suspect a lot of writers are exploring, really, is the theme of identity and what drives people to do the things they do and what makes us who we are. And I find that writing fantasy fiction or fiction with a kind of fantastical or science fiction edge to it gives quite a lot of opportunities to look at that, to put human beings in different contexts and see how they would respond and put them under different pressures and see what causes them to break, I suppose, with characters. So that's definitely a recurring theme in what I do. And I mentioned fantasy there. I mean, I think I tend to write a lot of different things, but I suppose they're all characterised by the fact they tend to have a mystery at the heart of them. They tend to be fantastical to some extent. They're kind of... I like to write the bizarre or the weird, I suppose, as well. So kind of not fantasy in a Tolkien sort of style, but more of a Mervyn Peake end of the spectrum, or a Guillermo del Toro type kind of fantasy, which is more rooted in folklore and mythology and British myths and legends and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's right in my wheelhouse as well.
it's something that I've had to learn, actually, over years of writing. It's the thing that I've learned is kind of where I do my best work, and it's the thing that I'm most passionate about. So I've kind of increasingly realised that one of the things I love to do is to create myths, really, I suppose. To play in that kind of folklore mythology and create new stories within that type of framework. So I'm doing more of it because it's just the thing that gets me excited, I suppose.
Fantastic. So let's talk about the key question that I like to ask. So in your career and all your different types of writing, what is the one thing that's been most helpful to improve your writing?
It's a good question. There are a few things, really. I think that there's a fundamental thing, actually, which is where I'll kind of start, which is about write, again, it's kind of tied to what I was just saying. It's about being true to yourself and writing for you. And I think, you know, I was talking before about how I used to get to chapter 7 in a novel and it would always collapse. So there were a couple of reasons why that would happen. And it was lack of planning, but it was also because I was trying to write the thing that I thought everyone wanted to read, if that makes sense. Mm. So at the time when I became a professional writer properly, I'd in the run up to that, I'd been reading a lot of kind of big space opera, I suppose, Peter F. Hamilton, Alistair Reynolds, that kind of thing. And I love that type of kind of big meandering saga that takes in lots of different star systems and things. But I knew, because I'd worked in bookselling, that there wasn't a lot of it at the time. That's what publishers were looking for, because on the back of those two big writers, and Stephen Baxter as well, they wanted more of it. So I kind of thought, right, well, that's what I'm going to do. I love reading this stuff, and I know that publishers want to buy it, so I'm going to go and I'm going to write the big space opera series. And I tried and I tried and I tried and I tried, and I got so disheartened because I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. I couldn't find the story that I wanted to tell it in the heart of it all. And it was a friend of mine, Michael Rowley, who's at the time was also a bookseller and worked for Waterstones for a long time, and then later became a publisher as well. I was talking it through with him, and he just said, "Look, stop. Write something for yourself. Just forget about whether you're going to get it published. Forget about who's going to read it. Just remind yourself why you love writing." And it was the best advice anyone's ever gave me, because I went away and I thought, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to write a story that's just fun for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to put in all the influences that I love, you know, Hammer Horror and Sherlock Holmes and Doctor Who and Steven Peele from the Avengers and mad fantasy, and you know, I'm just going to put all of that stuff in there. I'm going to write this story, and I started writing, and I had an inkling of what I was going to do, but I got past chapter 7, so I thought, all right, okay, I'll start putting a bit of framework to it. So I started to do a bit more planning, and I planned what this novel was going to be and what was going to happen to it, and I got about halfway through that plan, and it was going really smoothly, and I wrote to Mike and I said, "Michael, look at this. What this is what you've done for me. Thank you so much. I'm writing this book. It's called The Affinity Bridge." And Michael, unbeknownst to me, showed it to a publisher, who then came back and got in touch and said, "I've seen the first half of this book, and if you want to finish it, I'll buy it." Mm. Which was amazing. And that was my first break. And on the back of that, I saw more Newbin Hobbs, and then having finished the first book and sold it in the UK, it then went into a bidding war in the States. And, you know, that's where that series came from. That's where my professional writing career came from. And I to this day, I maintain that it was down to Michael sitting me down and saying, write something for yourself. So I've always tried to stay true to that. And whenever I've had a difficulty on a project, it's usually because I've not believed in the project. It might be something I'm doing that's changed direction or changed course, or it's a piece of work. You know, all of us, I think, as writers occasionally do take on a project because you think, oh well, you know, I'm interested in that subject, I'm interested in that world that it's a tie-in novel for, or and then you get into it and you think, actually, I am interested in that tie-in universe, but I don't necessarily have anything to say or anything new to say to add to it. And you know, that can be tough. And I kind of now, every project that comes along, I sit and think about, is this something I'm going to put 100% of my effort into? Because the reader deserves that. And I deserve that as the writer as well. So I think that's a great piece of advice from my friend there. And one that I recommend that everyone follows, that you don't follow your heart, not the market, because inevitably what happens, you know, if you jump on a bandwagon of a trend, by the time you've written your book, got it to an editor, got it to market, the trend's moved on. Mm. So you're chasing ghosts anyway, if you're chasing trends. Mm. Your best bet is to go, well, I'm going to tell a damn good story to the best of my ability and hope that people want to read it. That's not to say not to think commercially. You still have to be commercial about it. You still have to think about who are the readers for this book, and you have to take the advice of the editors who will help you shape that book to be a commercial book. Because of course, you know, books are there to be read, and you want to find readers. So I'm not advocating you completely ignore what's going on out there and what people want to read, but I do think it has to start with you. That belief in the project has to start with you.
Mm, okay. Yeah, fantastic advice. So now that you've moved into your Witchwood series, are you trying anything new at the moment?
Yeah, so Witchwood was quite a departure for me, actually. It was because up until that point, I'd written, 11, 12 novel, full-length novels and lots of novellas and stories and audios and comics and things. And a lot of them, all of the novels up to that point had all been set in the past, in one era or another. So all my Newbeen Hobbs books are set in a kind of Victorian / Edwardian period at the turn of the 20th century. I'd written another series, novels about a vigilante in 1920s New York. Or an alternate 1920s New York. I'd written a Doctor Who novel set in the Edwardian period. I'd written two Sherlock Holmes novels. I hadn't actually, other than the odd short story here and there, I hadn't written anything set in the modern day. And I really felt like it was time for me to do that. And that's where Witchwood started, really. It's a crime novel, like you mentioned, a police procedural with spooky stuff going on as well, like pagan occult thread going through it. All the crimes have their origins in folklore, and it was so being able to write a novel where the characters can actually pick up a mobile phone and call each other was was very freeing, but also I had to get used to it as well, because information passes a lot quicker in the modern world than it ever did in any of those historical periods I've worked in. Mm-hmm. So clues, you have to plan. And that was one where I really did have to plan as well. I had to plan the crimes, the reveals, the red herrings, every single clue and how it was, how the characters found out what was going on. Planned it meticulously. But loved writing it, every moment of it. A, because it was doing that thing that I talked about, which was exploring mythology, and it allowed me to kind of come up with a whole fake Saxon mythology about the Carrion King of the Witchwood, who's like this Robin Hood style figure in that he's been cast out. He lives in the woods, and he's created this band around him. He's brought these other outcasts together around him as his apostles. And through the mythology, each of those apostles eventually betrays him. In the modern day, someone is recreating the deaths of the apostles. Mm. And there's a spooky undercurrent for the reason why they're doing it. It's quite a personal book in the sense that it was I was able to draw a lot of my own actual experiences. Not that I was ever a pagan guy who lived in the woods, but the characters in the modern day. Thinking back to their childhood and events and being able to just actually write from observation, to go to the coffee shop and watch people and apply that to the book was quite liberating. So it was a lot of fun to do. That idea of writing a proper crime novel as well. And the Newbeen Hobbs books all have a mystery, and sometimes it's a murder mystery, but they're at their heart, they're adventure novels, really, I suppose. Whereas this is very much a crime novel in the sense that there's a female reporter, Ellie, who's the main character, and her psychic is Peter, who's the detective sergeant, and they work together to solve the crimes. You see that proper investigation. Working in a different...
How did you go with that? Because that's one of the parts whenever I do like crime fiction as well. And when I think about writing a crime fiction, for example, it's that because you need to be, so factual there with your police actual procedures. How did you go about with that?
Well, I cheated a bit because Ellie's a reporter, I was able to do some work from her point of view as well. So, she's asking the questions that that you or I would in those circumstances, having not been police trained. The stuff with Peter, I cheat a little bit in that he probably goes a little bit further than he'd be allowed to in terms of letting her get involved in his investigation. So he, if he got, and actually I'm touching on that in the second book, because he's realised he's been reprimanded. He knows he can't do it again. So he's keeping out of the crime scenes, for example. But I've got, there's a fantastic book I've got actually, which is a guide to British police procedures for crime writers.
Oh, wow.
And it's fantastic. It's written by a writer and a policeman who've worked together to put this book together, or an ex-policeman. So you can look stuff up. You can say, actually, well, how would a pathologist behave in these circumstances? How would a detective sergeant go about breaking down a crime scene in these circumstances? So that's been a huge crutch for that component of the book.
So you haven't been hanging around the local police station? Just
no, I have been tempted. I know someone told me that you can actually book an appointment and pay to have time, certainly with the Metropolitan Police, to interview them and talk to them about the process. And I haven't yet inquired to see whether I can do that in Lincolnshire in my local constabulary, but I would like to do it actually, to get some proper hands on stories and meet some of the characters, the people who are actually living this stuff, because there's always a gap, isn't there? When you there's what the textbook says that people do, and then there's what people really with real hands on experience do. So that's something I'd like to scratch at a bit more, actually.
And especially, the picture in our heads of the police, influenced by the Bill or something like that, which may not be like real life.
Well, yeah, that's it as well. I'm addicted to TV crime drama, things like Endeavour and Lewis and Morse and Midsummer Murders even, which I suppose is the cosier end of it. I love all that type of programming, and I suppose Witchwood has the flavour of some of that as well. My kind of the initial premise was really to do a story that felt like a Sunday night BBC or ITV crime drama, but with a kind of dark, spooky element to it as well. That was kind of what I was aiming for.
Sounds awesome. So what you touched on a few space opera writers, but what writers inspire you?
There's a lot. I believe it's part of the writer's job to read widely and as much as possible. There's a few. M. John Harrison, Mike Harrison, is one of my absolute faves. Just because he's prose is the most beautiful prose I've ever read. He clearly crafts every single word, and it pays off. He doesn't publish novels very regularly. There'll be, five, sometimes 10 years between novels, but when you get one, they're worth it. Proper works of art. So M. John Harrison for prose. An author who I've admired for a long time, but I've only really recently got stuck into the main body of his work, is Stephen Erickson, the fantasy writer. I'm working my way through the Malazan books at the moment, and they're fantastic. They're really fantastic. I think he's for the scale and the imagination in them. They're more traditional fantasy than what I write, but they're not traditional at all. Again, they kind of eschew the Tolkien model, and they go their own way. I just found, you know, you read this thousand page tome, and you think, right, now I'm gonna cleanse my palate and read some different things, and you pick other things up, and none of them are as good, and you want to go back to the next Stephen Erikson book, because that story, although it's 10 volumes in the main series, feels like one book, because it's one rich saga. So very inspired by him at the moment. Susan Cooper, The Dark is Rising sequence is a touchstone for me, an absolute touchstone. It's everything I love about fiction, and it sets the tone for a lot of my writing. You know, I talked about mythology and folklore and kind of that hidden England or hidden Britain and all of that kind of stuff. And for me, she's the master of that. And in terms of crime novels, I've been reading a lot of Peter Robinson. Again, you know, extremely well plotted. I'm usually guessing until fairly close to the end. Great character as well, both in terms of the actual people and the setting, which is close to my heart because it's set in the north, close to where I grew up. So that it kind of evokes that for me as well. So there's a handful of writers who kind of have been really important for me in terms of inspiration.
Excellent. So I think I'll start wrapping up so I can give you a chance to get back to all of your different pieces that you're working on. So, but firstly, what are you working on right now?
So I'm working on a sequel to Witchwood. So I've already written another Newbery and Hobbs novel, which is working its way through the editorial systems. But in the meantime, I'm working on this new Witchwood novel called Hallowedeen. So it's a sequel, in as much as it's Ellie and Peter investigating another series of crimes. This time I'm exploring 17th century witchcraft as kind of the backdrop. Mm. But obviously it's another modern day crime, with its roots in what happened to a woman who was accused of witchcraft in the 17th century and hung. And her story really is playing out in the modern day. So I'm kind of looking at how history repeats itself, how history is cyclical in nature, and you know, the echoes of the past affect the future. So they're kind of the themes that I'm playing with. So early stage, well, it's quite meticulously planned at this point. So I'm in the early stages of the writing, but the whole book's planned out. Chapter plan to work from.
Fantastic. Okay, so we'll look forward to that. Do you have any idea where that might be out?
I think we're looking at September time. So it's the anniversary of the first one, so it's we want to try and keep that momentum up.
Fantastic. Okay, so I'll let you get back to it then so that you can make sure that you meet that deadline.
Absolutely.
So where if people are interested in learning more about you, George, where can they find you and your work?
So hopefully my book should be available wherever good books are sold. So local bookshops, Amazon. Yeah, I thought that would be your best bet. An iBook store and places like that for eBooks. And I have a website. I'm not very good at updating it, I've got to be honest. It's george-man.com. But actually, Twitter's the best bet if people want to find me. I'm always kind of popping up on Twitter, and if people ask me questions, I tend to answer them as well. So if people want to find me on there, I'm always talking about my new book and my latest project on there as well. So if people want to find out what I'm up to, that's a good starting point.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today, George.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Today's tip is another technique from Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. Known as the artist date, the purpose of this is to go experience play in some way. Now, once a week, you get out of your usual writing cave and go and experience something fun to re-inspire and reinvigorate your creative spirit. Go do something nourishing on your own. Yes, the artist date is ideally a solo activity. Things I like to do on an artist date is go look at visual art, a gallery, or visit a museum, or I get out into nature or go for a walk or a run. Ideally, I'd travel somewhere new and experience something different, but that's not really convenient. And so what I often do in my own city and suburb is I'll take a different route to work, go to a different coffee shop and people watch, or wander through the park in my lunch hour. What I also try and do is get away from anything with a story. Often I relax with books or films or TV, but that's still got all the whole story thing going on. And part of my brain is still analysing characters and harking back to my own writing. You know, ooh, that's a good phrase, or maybe my character should do that. But with nature or visual art or travel, the story is less apparent and you can indulge your other senses. I also find non-fiction inspiring for ideas, including documentary. But with the rise of lots of very talented narrative non-fiction writers and documentary filmmakers, there's often a narrative arc in their storytelling too. So to reinvigorate your creative energy, what are you going to do this week? What are you going to get out and about and do? How are you going to have some fun? Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?